The following Dharma talk was given by Jodi Hojin Kimmel at the Zen Center of New York City. Hojin Sensei is the abbot of the Zen Center and head priest at Zen Mountain Monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org/zcnyc. Thanks for listening.
Good afternoon. It's nice to have a nice, intimate group here. So when I go back to the monastery, I've been whittling down, particularly my book collection. And as many of you know, probably from your own experience, you start looking into the books that you're going to get rid of, and you get involved, and you end up spending like time with something longer and longer. And so the book I was holding was The Three Pillars of Zen, which I had from way back. And I couldn't decide. I was like, should I keep this one? I've had it so long, and it served me so well, and you know, I could go to the library, but this was my Three Pillars of Zen. And so I started to read it, and I was really reappreciating these three essentials of practice and how that has still true. It's still true. So I wanted to touch on that today. I thought it would be good for Zazenkai and in our life and in our practice. And there was a quote from Roshi Kaplo, which says, Zen comes as a reminder that if we do not learn to perceive the mystery and beauty of our present life, our present hour, we shall not perceive the worth of any life, of any hour. Dashan's enlightenment, which he mentions in their case 28 of the Gateless Gate, Dashan says, the writer says, Zen ultimately rests in mystery and uncertainty. Master Lin Chi says, have confidence in the light always working inside you. Whatever confronts you, trust the light within. So over these Ango months, we've been looking at right relationship to the world and expressing our gratitude. The awakened way, the Buddha way, is living in the flow of impermanence. That's the Buddha way. Buddha's great enlightenment, a good part of it was seeing the impermanence, every moment of life, as being impermanent. And it's unattainable because it has no beginning, since it's impermanent, has no beginning and no end. It's flowing on. So we vow to attain it. It's only ever here in the present moment, and we learn to perceive the mystery and beauty of our present life, our present hour, grounded in the flow of impermanence, which it is. It's a fact. And the way he taught is that we need to learn to surrender to this truth. That's all it is. All of practice. To surrender to the truth, the fact of impermanence. We surrender by stilling the mind, the human brain. It can get quiet. We may not think so, but it can get quiet. It's been conditioned to believe that we are permanent, solid. In certain respects, maybe part of us says impermanent and then some get solid. Conditioned to believe that illusion of permanence. awakening from this illusion is what we call practice of the way. And awakening is not a one-time thing. It's pretty ongoing. So if you're looking for the big boom, it's pretty continual if you haven't noticed. Continual awareness that needs to be continually maintained. And such maintenance, as we know, might be quite difficult. And it's what we call practice. We are learning something about resting in awareness and becoming more trustful of knowing quality of mind, a quality of mind beyond concepts, bringing the mind back from getting lost in sense objects or with problems. Doesn't mean the mind disappears, that it dies. Quite the opposite. Taking the mind off its preoccupation with the endless series of specific objects, thoughts, problems, we allow the mind to get bigger, faster, clearer, beyond imagination, just taking it off of the objects, resting in awareness. We're learning how to stay with the displays of mind, stilling our brain. Right? Uchiyami, if you read the opening the hand of thought, he speaks about the brain loving its many secretions. It's very funny. The mind loves its secretions. And we're self-liberating what has never been bound. We've never been bound. Never. Ever. It's the thoughts, right, that bind us. How we think, how we perceive. That's what binds us. Emotions, perceptions, already free in and of itself. Nothing needs to be liberated by an outside force trying to be rid of anything. Impossible. Impossible. We let be. We let be. That's hard to let be. We're always tinkering. Mind always gets in there and tinkers. Little tinkerer. Let impermanence do its thing. Stop blocking it. Cloud rolls in and out. A wave comes in, a wave goes out. A turbulent wave, a calm wave. Stay within the recognition of awareness. That's enlightened. That's an enlightened view. So, what supports do we have in our practice? And in one sense, we have the exterior structures. The structure of Sangha, the discipline of posture, the way we place our hands and our eyes, the ways we move in the Zendo, instruments with signals. These are all structures that help us, give us exterior support to do what we need to do. What about the, and then there's services, rituals, oryoki, that too. And what about the internal, interior supports that we're offered? Well, we're offered what's already intrinsically in us, but we're made aware of it. Kapalo Roshi wrote about the three pillars of Zen practice. And he likened it to having three legs on a stool, that you can't have a stool without these three legs. That's us. You know, if you have two, boom, boom, it's going to fall over. So you have to have these three. It can't function fully as that kind of stool. Great faith is what we have in the interior. Our great faith our great doubt, and our great determination. And I think of that great, I don't know why this came up, it's kind of silly, but there used to be a Frosted Flakes commercial with Tony the Tiger. And someone asked him how Frosted Flakes were, and he said, they're grr, you all must know this, grr, and he would say that great so big that he would fall, like it was this whole combustion, this body. That's how boundless great is, like maha, maha prajna paramita. Somebody after that Sago Beers actually got me a bowl with Tony the Tiger on it. After that, I said that once. These great pillars we have. And what I would like to do in re-examining them is show what these pillars are not, so I can show you what they are at the same time. And we do that a lot. What something's not, so we can actually say what it is. It's easier that way. And also to show how they're so intrinsically linked that you can't have one without the other. It's the whole stool. So great faith in Zen. It's not a belief, and that's often associated with faith, I think. Faith is trust also. It's about trust. And for many of us, this word faith, of course, might be difficult to grasp. Perhaps from our religion, there's a fear that we're not going to measure up to something. We're not good enough. Or we are good enough. Or we have the right and wrong faith, that we're not doing it right, our faith, rather than a cure or a medicine. That trust is a cure or a medicine for our fear, our confusion. When it's Dharma wisdom, that's how it functions. So these days, faith is used a lot, and it's very elusive, slippery, a questionable commodity. There seems to be a great deal of effort to keep us from feeling what we feel, that we shouldn't have access to our wisdom, and question. There are times I feel I am forced to believe something expressed by others that seems to be true, even if it's about cold relief medicine or a pair of sneakers. Pair of socks. Like I have to have these. Like, this is what I need to trust. This pair of sneakers. Well, the message is that we lack or we need something and we don't know what is best for ourselves. So even though we practice Buddhism, it doesn't mean that we're infused with the spirit of trust, of faith, of inquiry. Although this is what's encouraged and taught. So belief and trust are pretty close in meaning. But there's different nuances in how faith is practiced. Belief is much more a belief in someone or something. And trust is in a much less tethered way, in that way. So let's take, for example, going out on a tree limb. Most of us love to climb trees at some point if you've had that opportunity and you like to do that. If I go out on the limb of a tree with faith, I don't go out believing in the tree limb. That implies a kind of certainty in the tree limb. I have faith in the tree limb. I believe in you, tree limb. I'm going to go out on you. Kind of like that. Rather, I go out on that limb trusting. Trusting something, not the tree limb, In both cases, I do need to examine the limb as well. But trusting in it rather than believing it, to go out with trust, I proceed with more uncertainty, much more unknowing. I proceed, but in trust. So if we apply this to the Buddha way, the awakened way, the way of impermanence, what on earth is there to believe in impermanence? What on earth is there to believe in impermanence? The reality of impermanence, not the idea. What is there to believe in? Belief as an idea is easy, since impermanence is a fact. I believe in impermanence. Sure, any scientist, any person, you just pull someone off the street, they'll believe in impermanence. Things are impermanent, constantly changing, in a constant state of flux. That's what we hear. This is a fact. It's easy to believe this. If we take away the idea of impermanence, the idea, what do we have? What do you have? When impermanence is not an idea, but a lived experience, it's not anything. It's not anything. It's not. Not is not anything, like the Heart Sutra. And yet not is not nihilistic. It's not a black hole. When not is allowed to arise from the still mind, when not arises in this way, it's undefinable. It's ungraspable, kind of alive. There's aliveness, movingness, lifeness, the aliveness of impermanence. I'll repeat it. Impermanence is not definable. It's ungraspable. There is nothing to believe. We can't believe in undefinable and ungraspable. What is there to believe? There's nothing to believe in. We can only trust in, right? Just trust in it. What is the thing in it to believe? We can only trust in it. At least that's my experience. So the pillar of great faith is the great trust in not anything. This notness, that's not K-N-O-T, it's N-O-T, notness of impermanence. Faith evolves through our understanding of this not anywhere to landness. Not any, I like that, ness, because it makes things in motion. Not anywhere to landness, not knowingness, not fixedness. What keeps us from maintaining this trust in living fully in impermanence? We probably grasp it. I know we all do to some degree. And we want to live this way. We want to trust. What keeps us or maintaining this trust? It's our humanity, our human conditioning. Nature, birds, animals don't seem to have a problem living in impermanence, or at least we don't hear about it. Maybe we need to listen more carefully, and maybe they do have a problem with it. But we do, because we know. We know through this muscle in our head, And the arising of this knowing, this knowingness, is inexhaustible, isn't it? I know. And this is why we need the other pillars of Zen, the other legs of our stool. Great doubt, great inquiry. David White writes about the ability to ask a beautiful question. The ability to ask beautiful questions, often in very unbeautiful moments, is one of the great disciplines of a human life. And a beautiful question starts to shape your identity as much by asking it as it does by having it answered. You have to just keep asking. And before you know it, you will find yourself actually shaping a different life, meeting different people, finding conversations that are leading you to in those directions that you wouldn't have even seen before. Some of us are good questioners. I don't think I have been. I've been a terrified questioner in a knowing way. My body always was asking, I think. There's other ways to ask questions. So I think there was a schism. It's like this part of me was like, I don't know, what? I don't know. And this part was like, I think I should know. I'm scared to ask. And some people just have that all the time, this great doubt. It's like amazing. So what doubt is not? It's not the same as skepticism, not that kind of doubt, the skeptical doubt. A little bit's okay, but if it overwhelms you, if you're too much of a skeptic, you're not going to get anywhere if you're always doubting in that skeptical way, where we evaluate what it is we're being with through the filter of our conditioned mind knowings. So if what we see or hear does not quite agree with our ideas about it and what we know about it, skeptical doubt can arise. Some of us know this really well. This does not agree with my notions, so I doubt. I don't know what that I can do to open it up. I have to be wary of it because my mind doesn't know what it is about. Those kinds of things. So skeptical doubt is kind of a form of defending ourselves. I don't know what it is, so I can't even listen. Ego self-defense. Although skeptical is useful at times in social interactions, it doesn't have a lot of use in Zen practice. Maybe a little, like the kid that throws an eraser in the classroom behind your back if you're a teacher. It's good. In fact, it can turn into a poison, right? Because it keeps us from going further into not knowing. We always want to know. And the great doubt of our practice is not about defending the ego self. It's about piercing the illusory ideas of the egoic self that we create constantly, ceaselessly. Above all, the illusion that this self is separate and distinct, separate from all other selves. So in the reality of impermanence, which we're trying to surrender to, not understand, but surrender to, there can be no self. Constant change does not allow a self to form. It's like the flowing stream. As soon as the water's here, we can't step in that same place again. It's different. So, what can form? What self can form? It's moving on. We can't stop. stop it. We can't stop it in the same place. That's why in the Diamond Sutra it says, those who strive to live the Buddha way, the way of impermanence, are called stream enterers. The stream enterers. We strive to be stream enterers. That's our constant practice. Just stream entering, flowing along. Not stopping and making something. But the mind, full with this illusory knowledge and knowing, keeps blocking the entry. That entry, that surrender to impermanentness. And that's why great doubt is needed. To bore like a drill through that large mass, that mountain of ideas we have about everything, including who this is, who you are. That doubt. I don't know. Do you know? I don't know. What is this? I don't know what this is. And that is knowing what this is. It's not. That's it. The drill of great doubt is questioning, great questioning. A better word might be great ceaseless questioning. That's the drill that goes through the mountain. So anytime we or anyone asks, who am I? What's reality? Why am I not at peace? What is happening? I don't understand. There it is. We're raising that potential for great questioning, to keep that open. Questioning of the mind's givens, ideas, and answers. So he says, we shape our identity as much by asking it as it does by having it answered. So sometimes there's no answer. That's the answer. Keeping it in the stream. And questioning can and does lead to discombobulation. Scary. Choppy. Seemingly difficult, lost moments when we don't know. Breaking through the layers of permanences created by the ego mind is not fun. I think Trungpa has a line. He starts a chapter, "This is not fun." It's like, thank you, Trungpa. But oh, the freedom it brings from the sufferings created by that aspect of mind. The freedom it brings. Activating, arousing, questioning. It's difficult. It was difficult for Shakyamuni Buddha. It's difficult for us. You see that in all the sutras. That's why all along the way we need great trust. Trust that strangeness, the uncertainty, the lostness, the activation of great questioning brings us about. Is the way, is actually the path. And I say this too because as I was working with Yukon's passage, I had to keep remembering this stream. Feel what I was feeling, but also we were in the flow of the stream together. It was the right path. Had to happen at some point. The truth of impermanence must be surrendered, not just once, but endlessly, moment after moment. That is the way, and this requires constant questioning. As soon as we land somewhere, that's not it. So why cling to it? Why hold on? Not holding on to anything. That's the practice of impermanence. That's the practice of not anything. So great trust, great questioning, they're not separate. They function together, held in mutual support. Great trust needs great questioning in equal measure, held in mutual support by the third leg of the stool, great determination. What determination is not? It's not about a clenched jaw, a furrowed brow, a tight body, controlling, fiercely sitting, practicing so very hard that your shoulders are up and stiff. That kind of practice can so easily derail us, has derailed many practitioners, getting so tight, trying to achieve passivity, generate so much activity, as the Faith Mind poem states. You know, you're sitting there and you're like, I need to be still. I need to be quiet. We're getting like, oh my God, be still, be quiet. And we get tighter and tighter and harder. But we have to go through that to see that's not it. This is unsustainable. So perhaps a better word for commitment is commitment to trusting. Commitment is commitment. A better word for determination is commitment. Commitment to trusting, commitment to questioning, commitment to doubting in equal measure as being vehicles of the way of impermanence. The way that can only be sustained through commitment. Great commitment to allowing great faith and great doubt to operate as freely as possible, to allow our great trust, our great faith, and our great doubt to allow to flow, to operate as freely as possible. That's great commitment. Great commitment to that. Without great faith and great doubt, great commitment becomes nothing other than concentration. You see that? Just concentrating. No, we need to have that doubt, that questioning. It doesn't mean you're bringing up a concept or a question, but just the whole of us is just in that questioning mode, questioningness of what? Just living alive in that impermanence of not knowing and trusting that, trusting no answers in particular ways. So that's why I encourage art practice all the time, because it takes you right to that. That is art practice. That is the creative process. You are flowing in not knowing. You have to know things first. We know. I'm not saying ditch your knowledge or not know things. We need to know things, but to what end? So we learn to a technique, we learn instruments, we learn voice, and then you have to go beyond it. You just bring up the doubt and the trust, and you enter, you commit. You just commit and trust. Like, you know, I watch some of these artists like work with like weirdest materials, and they so trust it. Like, this woman's been collecting junk from the ocean for like ever. Like, and she trusts it. It's like she has complete faith in and commitment to what this is doing. There's a great doubt there. She's bringing up something she doesn't even know herself. But it's total faith in the process and what's happening without knowing. She knows things, obviously. It's so exciting. Maybe that's why everyone stays away from art practice, because you have to like whew, get in the stream. And it's like it shakes up that knowing. You know, it's like, you know, there's conceptual work, and that has its place, but there's also this other third thing, fourth thing, fifth thing, other dimensional thing that happens. And that happens on the cushion. I mean, how many dimensions are we in on the cushion? It's like, I don't know. We travel. I don't know what dimension I'm in and who I'm in touch with. Great trust. That's why we can contact ancestors. That's why we can receive things just out of the blue, seemingly, because it's an open highway. But in our knowing, we flatten the world. So we're living in that knot, at the same time. We're practicing to open to that impermanence, that bigness. It's so freeing. Great trust, great questioning, great commitment. So I offer great encouragement to reflect on these pillars. Arouse, activate, and practice them in yourself. They are there for our interior Zen practice support. Now, until our last breath. And I'll end with a poem by Otagaki Rengetsu. It's called Heart. Drifting like white clouds from beginning to end. A thing of mystery is this heart. Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as cushions, incense, liturgical instruments, Dharma books, and more, visit monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.